Welcome to MedEvidence, where we help you navigate the truth behind medical research with unbiased, evidence-proven facts, powered by Encore Research Group and hosted by cardiologist and top medical researcher, Dr. Michael Corrin.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Corrin, and I'm delighted to be here with a great colleague, Steve Tengis, and we're going to talk about headaches. And as a physician, as a clinical researcher, and as somebody that runs a business, I have a lot of headaches. So I'm hoping that in this MedEvidence Hour, you're going to help us understand headaches and maybe help me and a lot of other people with your knowledge.
Well, that would certainly be the goal, and I would, I'm delighted at the opportunity. I'm Stephen Tengis. I'm a neurologist in Jacksonville. We do general neurology and certainly have a subspecialty niche of headache medicine for sure. And this is basically what we do.
Yeah. So first of all, Steve is an amazing neurologist. He's fabulous, and he's a go-to guy in this area in Northeast Florida. So thank you for what you do for our patients, and thank you for what you do for research. Mm-hmm. And you also have taught me a lot over the years, and you've been involved in clinical research here. So let's help everybody else understand what it is that you do, what it is that you know. And let's start with the basic concept about what is a headache, what are the different types of headaches. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I alluded to some headaches of what I have to do day to day, and we all have those in our lives. But those are fundamentally different type of headaches compared to cluster headaches or migraine headaches. So there's a lot of terminology out there that people really don't understand quite that well in my experience. So why don't you start by telling us what is a headache and what are the types and why they're important to have different types?
So there are a lot of misconceptions about what types of headaches people experience specifically with migraine. I'll sort of focus in on or pay attention specifically to migraine because there are a lot of misconceptions.
Are migraines the worst kind of headaches or different categories or equally bad?
So therein lies some of the uncertainty. There are diagnostic criteria for all of the headache disorders that humans experience. Mm-hmm. It's called the International Classification of Headache Disorders. Okay. It's on its third revision, and it's very easy to access online.
Okay.
And so those are a very well thought out and validated through the years and then thus revised set of diagnostic criteria. And so with our migraine criteria, we really think of headaches that have a couple of particular types of characteristics. There's four main characteristics to consider, them being unilateral, them being pulsating or throbbing.
Unilateral is one side.
On one side of the head. Being pulsating or throbbing in character.
Does that mean they're vascular because they're pulsating? Sometimes people have
not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily.
Sorry to interrupt
you.
Going.
No, you're good. Yeah. So unilateral pulsating, moderate or severe in intensity. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, migraines are often moderate or severe in intensity. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one is aggravated by or requires avoidance of routine physical activity. Mm-hmm. You really just need two of those characteristics. Mm-hmm. And so if you had a unilateral or one-sided headache that was throbbing, it wouldn't need to be severe. As a matter of fact, it could be mild. Mm-hmm. Now, most migraines are going to be moderate or severe, but it can be misleading because the headache does not need to be moderate or severe. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it's even possible to have a migraine and have no pain. And so along with the other four characteristics of migraineous headaches, the criteria would require light and sound sensitivity or nausea. The person does not need to have nausea. You don't need to have light and sound sensitivity if you have nausea and you can still satisfy the diagnostic criteria. It's important to understand that the light sensitivity and sound sensitivity that can come with migraines does not need to be severe. A lot of times patients are confused by the fact that light will bother them. It's just not that bad. They will turn the lights off, and if they've got a migraine, the radio or the TV are not on, and that counts. That behavior is there because they are light and sound sensitive, and so the photo and photosensitivity can be relatively mild. It does not need to be severe. That's a very common reason why someone is confused about a diagnosis of migraine.
Okay. So before we get more into migraines, we're going to spend a lot of time on that since we do the research in that.
Sure.
But just for the audience, people talk about tension headaches. They talk about sinus headaches. They talk about cluster headaches.
Yes.
Do they really have the same type of specific diagnostic criteria, or are they just general terms?
Absolutely. They're definitely defined very specifically. Okay. I think a lot of the confusion comes with tension and migraine, tension being the most common primary headache disorder that humans experience, migraine being the most common severe primary headache disorder that humans experience. I think it's interesting to look actually at the diagnostic criteria. And if you do and you read migraines criteria and tension headaches criteria, you'll notice that the generators of the criteria just took migraine diagnostic criteria and put the word not in front of each the criteria, and that is tension headaches criteria.
Oh, interesting.
So they're not unilateral. They're not throbbing. They're not moderate or severe, and they're not exacerbated by routine physical activity. That's literally the tension criteria.
How about cluster? Does that mean anything?
Absolutely. So cluster is very different, mentioning cluster does bring up a very useful aspect of diagnostic criteria. Duration of a headache is a very, very important piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. Migraines untreated or unsuccessfully treated last between 4 and 72 hours. Mm-hmm. They don't last 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Cluster headaches are generally fairly easily differentiated from migraines based on simply the duration of the headache. Mm-hmm. A cluster headache really does not last more than 180 minutes. So it's not up to 3 hours. And usually it's down around 30 minutes, maybe an hour. Hmm. And cluster headache is severe or very severe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so cluster headaches are quite different and have a lot of
autonomic. They hit you hard and they hit you quickly.
They do. They do. And they're not nearly as common as migraine. Mm-hmm. You mentioned one, sinus headache. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is often confused with migraine, because migraine can hurt in the region of our sinuses. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of what is even diagnosed by physicians as a sinus headache is migraine. The, mm-hmm. the statistics are 85% of what a physician diagnoses mm-hmm. as a sinus headache is migraine.
Oh, interesting.
And so almost all sinus headache is migraine.
Interesting.
Yes.
And is there any way to distinguish that? If they respond to antihistamines, it's more sinus, or?
The diagnostic criteria.
Okay. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I'm sure there are other categories. I know there's post-concussive headaches and mm-hmm. others. Is there any other major ones that you want to bring to the fore?
You know, we do see a lot of post-traumatic, post-concussive headache syndromes. A significant percentage of the time, I would say a majority of the time, when we're seeing these patients in clinic, they are actually a migraine patient whose headaches have increased in severity after the putative trauma. And so sometimes it's difficult to really decipher the difference between a post-traumatic headache syndrome and a migraine syndrome. Mm-hmm. Post-traumatic headaches are often migrainous. They often have very typical migrainous characters. And when we look at studies on efficacy, it is migraine-based therapies that wind up demonstrating efficacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Limited studies.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Any other major categories to throw out there?
I don't think so. I think those are, you know, it's really, migraine is just such a common issue.
Sure.
One in five females, 1 in 10 males have migraine.
Wow. So that brings up an interesting issue. So my headaches is a big problem in terms of workplace productivity, mm-hmm. among other things. Obviously, mm-hmm. We like to relieve people's symptoms, but mm-hmm. it's interesting from what I've heard, insurers are actually very positive about paying for migraine treatments and other headache treatments because of the productivity issues at the workplace. So you may want to comment on that.
So in global burden of disease studies, where we're really assessing the impact of a particular syndrome on essentially disability or the ability to function in life and at work. In the global burden of disease studies, migraine is number two in the list of most disabling conditions. In women of childbearing ages, it's clearly number one.
Wow.
And so it is by far you know, one of our top most
number one being heart disease, I assume?
No, number one's lower back pain.
Really?
Yes, low back pain.
Wow.
And so there are different ways to sort of slice up the disability with migraine. There is, of course, what we refer to as absenteeism, right? So someone's missing work because they have a bad migraine or unable to function for that day. There's also what we term presenteeism, meaning the person stays at work.
And but is worthless.
It is basically worthless. And it's actually the presenteeism that has a bigger drain on our, you know, a bigger drain on the economy than actual absenteeism.
Interesting. So let's talk about two other things in the beginning of our conversation. One is genetics of headaches, and two are the triggering elements of headaches.
You know, in terms of genetics, I think that the genetic stuff is not really ready for prime time in terms of we're not regularly doing any kind of genetic assessments in clinics. I do believe that that is the future to come.
Do migraines run in families?
Is that definitely. Okay. There's no question.
There is a genetic component. We just don't understand it well.
Strong genetic component. Okay. Yes, absolutely. You would term it a polygenetic disease.
Got it.
And yes, if a parent, one parent is a migrainer, the likelihood of any individual offspring being a migraine patient is 80%.
Wow.
And if both parents are migraine patients, it's 95%.
Okay. So that's not Mendelian, but there's something going on there.
Clearly.
Interesting.
Yes.
And then talk about triggers. I know that's a huge discussion point for people that have headaches.
I would tie trigger discussions up with lifestyle, you know, suggestions. You know, we often are not aware of the impact of our sleep habits on various things. Definitely migraine is extremely sensitive often to, you know, derangements in our circadian rhythm. You know, certain food-related triggers, generally those tend to be pretty obvious to a person. I mean, if somebody drinks a glass of red wine and, you know, a high percentage of the time they are vomiting in the bathroom with a severe pounding headache when they do that, they figure that out very, very easily.
Or they're on a GLP-1 agonist.
Right, correct. And so the dietary and behavioral triggers are often pretty well known to a patient. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, that's something I ask the patient, they tell me, I don't tell them. Mm-hmm. But there are triggers like dehydration, mm-hmm. i.e. you should drink water and stay hydrated. Mm-hmm. Prolonged fasting, skipping meals is actually often a prominent migraine trigger. So we should eat regular, healthy meals. Mm-hmm. Altering, you know, circadian rhythms, bed and wake time, sleeping enough. And then the last behavioral, you know, approach we would say is exercise. Exercise is actually very useful. And so
exercise causes headaches or relieves them?
It's very beneficial to have regular exercise. One special trigger that I would point out is something that, you know, is just extremely potent would actually be musculoskeletal neck pain. Pain in our mid and upper cervical spine is very commonly really the trigger or culprit that ends up with a patient, you know, needing to come to our clinic. Yeah, it is. And it's very useful to identify that because there really are some special physical therapists in the community who are capable of impacting the neck pain related trigger and thereby the headache syndrome with essentially exercise, stretching, and careful strengthening. And that's not a medicine.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. So a little bit more clarity on the amount of time from trigger to symptoms that would be typical. I know some people aren't 100% sure if something caused it and what that time course should be.
I would say it's variable because a migraine event, remember the pain part of it, I alluded to being a 4 to 72 hour window event. There are different phases of migraine. There is the painfully obvious pain phase. That's when there's pain.
Right.
But there's a prodromal phase that can last hours to a full day or so before a migraine. And then there can be a postdrome or a quote-unquote migraine hangover after the pain is over. And so it could be difficult for someone to identify that a trigger tipped them off into a prodromal phase that may last as much as a day. But usually, I mean, our brains are very good at figuring out what kind of stuff is making us hurt.
Sure.
And so a person usually will figure that out.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So it's not usually necessary to do trial and error with regard to different substances and see what causes problems and what isn't. Very specific types of challenges per se.
I think that a person can't, you know, if somebody is having a difficult time with their migraines, there is some utility to focusing on potential dietary and behavioral triggers with filling out diaries and then keeping track of things in that manner. And most of the time, they're going to be, capable of identifying them. Some triggers are amazingly impressive, particularly smell-related triggers.
Really?
I mean, there are a high percentage of patients who, if they smell a particular perfume or a particular smell, will instantaneously have a migraine. Instantaneously.
Wow. Isn't that crazy? Yes.
High percentage.
Very, very interesting.
Often very disabling, especially if you're a teacher and you are a migraine with aura and your aura includes expressive aphasia and your teenage kids figure out that they can trigger a migraine in you and you can't talk.
Wow.
Yes.
Isn't that crazy?
True story.
Wow. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. She had to quit her job.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Huh. And that brings up another point. So do you need to have headaches and get the diagnosis of migraines? You hear about these other type of symptoms associated with migraineous problems. So do you need pain as part of that?
Oh, that's a great question. The answer is no. And so one of the phases that about a quarter of migraine patients are capable of having is the aura phase. A lot of people have generally heard of visual aura. You can get funny visual phenomena that can occur. Generally, a person will see something like a scintillation, a light, or a kaleidoscope that sort of grows and spreads across visual space. Visual or any other aura symptom is going to be something that will evolve over minutes, last less than an hour, typically 20 to 30 minutes, and then go away. Mm-hmm. Most commonly then being followed by the pain phase or the headache. But you can have aura and not have a headache. And there are people that are true acephalgic migraine or no head pain migraine or the official term, migraine aura not followed by headache in the international classification of headache disorders. I would point out the most common migraine aura symptom is a visual one. The second most common is an evolution of hemibody numbness.
Wow.
And the third is an expressive aphasia. Oftentimes, these will come 1, 2, 3, the visual aura, then the sensory aura, then the aphasia, and that lands patients in the emergency room.
Right. So aphasia, just for people's knowledge, means you can't speak.
Yes. You know what you want to say, but you can't get your words out.
Exactly.
And so one of our more common clinical scenarios is where we see people with one of their first aura events that includes aphasia or numbness in the emergency room for, suspected stroke.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Crazy stuff. Well, that was an amazing introduction to headaches. Appreciate that. So in our next segment, I want to talk about the treatments, and I'll give a little tease for that. It's anywhere from caffeine to Botox to a bunch of other things.
Thanks for joining the MedEvidence Podcast. To learn more, head over to MedEvidence.com or subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform.